Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast, the show for all things real food, where we take a deep dive to explore and build appreciation for real food and drink, as well as those processes that bring it to the table. All right, folks, this is a good one. I would go so far as to say that out of any of the conversations I've had on this podcast, this is probably my favorite one. In today's episode, I talked to Stephen Cornett, an urban farmer and market gardener based in San Diego, California. Stephen has turned suburban neighborhood land into amazing organic gardening systems that work in unison with nature. He grows vegetables, fruits, and even microgreens, and he has also incorporated some animals into his urban farming system. His mission is to teach as many people as he can about regenerative farming and really show you how you can grow healthy food for your family and friends, even if space is really limited. He does this on his YouTube channel, which is called Nature's Always Right, and for this channel he creates videos that really take a deep dive into his techniques behind his urban farm, and he really shows you the entire process and journey behind it. That's what I love about it. So if you're just a home gardener, or even if you want to make gardening your career one day, definitely check out this YouTube channel. It's so worth it. So some of the topics we talked about were Stephen's philosophy on gardening and food. Then we got into how to turn your garden into a system that works with nature. And this really includes ways to build a healthy and nutrient-rich soil without using any chemicals whatsoever. And then finally, we got into the topic of growing more in less space. Like I said, though, you know, these are just some of the many topics we touched on in this conversation. And make sure to stick around for the whole thing, because there's a lot of valuable bits at the end of the conversation. Stephen goes into his best practices for storing vegetables in the fridge, and he also shares some of his absolute favorite urban farming and gardening books. Okay, one final thing before we get into the episode. I just want to say thank you so much for all the great feedback I've been getting lately. You know, positive and negative. I really value feedback because that's what's going to help me make the show better for you guys. So if you do have feedback, please send me an email. The email address is theyearofplenty@gmail.com. Or you can also follow me on Instagram. My Instagram is @PoldyWheeland, all one word. And you know, the podcast is also on Facebook and Twitter. Just look up @TheYearOfPlenty. And the same really goes for 5-star reviews. Thank you so much for leaving all those 5-star reviews on the Apple Podcast app and on podchaser.com. Those reviews are crucial because that's what really gets the show ranked in the charts. And ultimately, that's what's going to allow new foodies like you and I to discover the show. So if you get value from the show, please leave a 5-star review. But, you know, I think I've said enough. Let's dive straight into the episode with Stephen. Hey, Stephen, how's it going? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Poldy, I'm doing great. It's good to be with you today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And I know you've been working hard today already, right? I saw it on your Instagram.
Yep. Yeah, we have been harvesting a bunch for customers.
And when does your day usually start?
You know, I'm usually up by 7 or 8. On market days, though, I'll get up earlier, like 6 a.m., so I can make sure everything's harvested and cleaned and packaged and everything before the market starts.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, let's back it up for the listeners a little bit here. So you are an urban farmer down in California, right?
Yep, San Diego, California.
And, you know, for the people who might listen, they know about farming, they know about gardening, but they might not know about urban farming or gardening. So in a nutshell, what is urban farming?
So urban farming is just utilizing the space in these suburban or even city lot areas. For my case specifically, I'm using a backyard of one homeowner's house and a front yard of another homeowner's house. And we've just exchanged essentially a free lease for me. I come in, I develop their property for them, making a really beautiful garden. I harvest and sell those crops. And then I'm giving them weekly vegetables from their land every single week.
I love how that relationship is working for you guys. And it's also cool to see that you're pretty much turning, you know, household yards or lawns into like marketable produce, right? That's essentially
yeah,
it on a smaller
absolutely.
Scale.
Yeah, very small, but very intensive scale. So all my beds are 30 inches wide. The pathways are about 8 inches wide. So it's mostly just vegetables out there and a little bit of room for me to work around.
Yeah. And so I'm curious about your journey, you know, how you got started in this. How did you get into farming? And then eventually, you know, how did you specialize in urban farming?
Yeah, well, I didn't start out as wanting to be a farmer. I used to hate doing yard work. My first job at 16 was working at a golf course doing, you know, weed whacking and things like that. So the initial start, I guess, I started getting interested in nutrition and kind of waking up to, gosh, you know, our food system, like reading really unhealthy food. The doctors really have no options for people as far as healing them of disease. They just give them pills to mask their symptoms. So I was kind of on that mindset. And my best friend, Jared Smith, started doing some gardening. You know, we were talking about it all the time, you know, just learning and researching, reading books like, was it The Omnivore's Dilemma?
Oh, great.
By
book.
Michael Pollan. Yeah, that was one of the first really eye-opening books for me. Seeing, you know, different documentaries like Food Inc. back in the day. And anyways, my best friend, Jared, he got the opportunity. His family owns a larger piece of land out here in San Diego, where it used to be a chicken farm, but now there's nothing there. So we were allowed to sort of build out a small garden that turned into a bigger farm, which is now like 1.5, almost 2 acres. And I helped him build that. So I have experience with a little bit bigger farms, and then a lot of different things happened in my life. I moved to Korea, I taught English there for a couple of years, and then came back because I still felt this call and passion to be a farmer again. So came back here, farmed again with Jared for another 6 months. Learned a lot more things through him, through all the different things that he had done over the past couple of years. He had integrated trees, polycultures, which is plantings of, you know, fruit, understory plants, perennial vegetables. He incorporated a lot more permaculture ideas. So then I took that and I said, okay, you know, I want to make my own farm now. And, you know, how am I going to be able to do that in San Diego where land is very expensive? I don't know anybody who can let me farm on their land. So that's where this whole model of urban farming was really, I guess, kind of pioneered and developed by Curtis Stone, the urban farmer.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about him. How was he an influence on you in that way?
Well, back when I was still farming with Jared, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago, he started making YouTube videos talking about how he was doing incredibly profitable farming on just, you know, backyards and front yards of people's properties. So I got his book and looked more into what he was doing. And he's very focused on these 5 attributes of growing crops. So how popular they are, how quickly you can turn them over in a bed. So things like radishes, they grow in 25, 30 days. So you can have a crop, pull it out, put the next one back in very quickly. So when you're focusing on these crops that you can turn over quickly, get a very high price at market, they're also usually less labor involved. Focusing on those crops specifically allow you to make a living on a smaller piece of land. Yeah, so I took those principles and started looking for a property where I could do this and start my own little farm.
And that's what led you to finding these people. How did you get in contact with the people that gave you their first property?
Yeah, they're pretty good family friends of our family. And like I knew the owner, I've known her since, I don't know, we were kids. So her and her husband they're a young family. They recently bought a house a few years back and they had a granny flat in the back that they wanted to rent out. And a bunch of land. It just, the timing worked out perfectly, basically. And
that's awesome.
And yeah, so presented the idea to them. They really liked it. So we just went forward and signed a lease.
And are you currently like a one-man show? Is it just you doing this?
Yeah, right now the last maybe 6 to 8 months, it's just me. My wife does help me on harvest days to package things and things, but I've had different volunteers. I've had an apprentice help me for 6 months. I've had little things like that. I've paid people occasionally when I needed a bunch of work done, like planting 150 tomato plants.
Oh yeah. I mean, that takes a long time, right?
Yeah. That took a while. So yeah, I'm a one man show though.
Okay, sweet. But it's nice that your wife's helping out. I feel like it's, you know, if you have a relationship where you can do something like that together, that's always nice, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love being able to do it with her every week.
So I'd love to dig a little deeper into your philosophy on, you know, farming and gardening in general. So let me back up. You actually have a YouTube channel too, right? You're not just farming. You're also doing a YouTube channel called Nature's Always Right. And then you're also on Instagram a lot. That's that's your other main channel that you probably put content out on.
Absolutely.
So why the name Nature's Always Right?
Yeah, so the deeper I studied nature, biology, soil science, plant biology, all these things, I couldn't deny the fact that God exists, that there is a design to all of this, the irreducible complexity of like just the soil food web alone, the interaction between the plants and the biology and how they're passing nutrients back and forth to each other. It blew my mind, and I just couldn't believe how amazing it all was. And so I was already on the whole organic, like we should do things as naturally as possible. But to me is more of an understanding of like, wow, there's this whole natural system and design to the whole planet on a macro scale and on a micro scale. And if we're working with the earth in a way that supports these systems, they're already perfect systems. Like you can't improve upon them, in my opinion. So let's work with those systems and encourage those systems to flourish as much as possible. And then we'll be able to have the best ecosystems, food, animals, all those things.
Yeah. And you know, that's something I want people to really grasp. And that's one of the reasons why I started a podcast. For me personally, my stepbrother, I'm originally from Germany. And my stepbrother over there, he started an apprenticeship to become an organic farmer. So, you know, I was definitely influenced by him exactly by those things that you just mentioned. And, you know, we started a little garden together. And that was the first time I really realized how connected everything is. And we obviously tried to do it organically, you know, without any chemicals and all that. So, yeah, that's really when I woke up to all this too, through gardening mostly. And then, you know, we do hunting and all that. So that's another way to really connect to nature in that way. And
that's really cool.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on like the current farming system, you know, the more conventional approach?
It's how we currently feed the world. I mean, we wouldn't, without these tractor-based, like huge acreage, you know, conventionally farmed things, like we wouldn't be able to eat in the large amounts that we are. But I would argue that we're eating all the wrong foods because of these farming systems. I mean, if you want to get into it, we can talk politics a little bit. It's very politically motivated. The more you look into it, just like, you know, the whole food system, like the growing of corn and soy and how they're using that for the animal feed, but these ruminant animals like cows aren't supposed to be eating grains. They're supposed to eat grass, which causes a whole lot of problems. My opinion, I think that we could do this large scale tractor farming with naturally derived nutrients, without synthetic nitrogen and things like that. We could do huge inoculations of soil biology using machines that would make these larger farms much more resilient and be able to produce crops with very minimal pesticide use or chemical use in general. As it stands, I don't think that we could feed the world with small farming like I'm doing, only because we don't have enough small farmers. If we have 10 million farmers that want to do this, and there's landowners that are willing to work with them, and you know, I could see something like that working. But even I've seen a huge influx into people that are interested in doing this as a business or just want to grow food for their family, but it's still nowhere near where we would need it to be. So like that leads me back to, well, we kind of do need this large agriculture system to feed people, but it's a double-edged sword because we're destroying the soil, we're destroying the oceans with all the runoff. And that's why I'm really interested in exploring naturally derived or naturally created nutrients. And it's kind of like the idea behind my YouTube channel is teaching people how to grow food, but teaching them how to do it with completely naturally. I don't use any type of pesticide or chemical of any type, but I do make my own compost and soil, worm castings, aerated compost and worm teas. I do Korean natural farming, which is a whole nother subset of organic agriculture where you're developing microorganisms, biostimulants, enzymes, and then actually raw nutrients like calcium and phosphate and things like this to feed to the plants. And so I my big goal, I guess, is to experiment with this more and try to influence this sort of thing happening on a larger scale.
Yeah. So what was that called? Korea farm?
Korean natural farming or natural farming is the other term for it.
Is that something you were exposed to when you were in Korea, or is that something you kind of, that was an
afterthought? A little bit. It actually happened more after. I mean, in Korea, there's farming going on everywhere. Their culture is still very tied to growing their own food. Much like it was in America, you know, 50, 60 years ago, everybody had a garden.
Oh, but, yeah. I mean, the famous Victory Gardens, right? I think they were called.
Yeah.
Where everyone in World War II had a garden because they knew food, you know, might be short at one point in time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or people in the Great Depression in America, a lot of them survived because they were able to grow food or hunt or, you know.
Yeah, that's something I love to kind of have instill in people's minds too a little bit more is that, you know, humans have always kind of prepared for bad times through gardening, through canning, pickling, you know, all those things. They've kind of, food's always kind of been in their minds, right? But, you know, we've become very complacent to that, I think.
Oh, big time. We're just, we're a convenience culture to the extreme now. So, I mean, a lot of people don't even know how to cook. They'll buy like a package of ingredients or a box from the store and then they heat that up. So, you know, that's going to backfire on them eventually. They're going to eventually start having big time health problems. And that's usually when people wake up and, you know, myself included, I had health problems. People in my family had health problems. That's what led us down this path. Ultimately, it wasn't because like, oh yeah, we want to eat as healthy as possible. And I find when I talk to other people too, like they can't make a change in their life. Like most people, some people can, they're stronger than I am, but they won't make a change until something dramatic happens or something that shakes them up.
Yeah, no, totally. So do you think you've noticed a difference in health and all that since you've started growing your own food on a larger scale? And I'm guessing you're mostly eating your own food, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I eat the food I grow. Another farmer that I work with, or Jared, me and him sell some food together. So I eat some of his, and then the rest I get from the farmer's market. So I don't go into a grocery store too often.
Wow. So you're pretty much separated from the whole grocery store system at this point.
For the most part, you know, I make a Costco trip every couple of months to load up on like essentials and things, you know, things like that. But my day-to-day produce, yeah, it's someone I know is growing it. And I don't know, I rarely get sick. I haven't been sick in the last 3 years. I have energy all day long. I can tell if I go off of my healthy diet and I start eating bad stuff and, you know, I get more inflammation, more like pain in my back when I'm working. Takes longer to heal injuries, you know, more brain fog. So I've played a lot with nutrition in the last 10 years. And nothing has made a bigger difference than growing my own food and eating that food.
Well, and then also, I really think, you know, the work you're doing has to be very rewarding when you're, you know, you're growing your own food and you're always working outside in the garden. You're really engaging with nature in a way. I personally notice that when I'm gardening, when I'm weeding or something, you know, it's almost like all worries go away. You're just focused on your task. It's almost like a meditation, to be honest. And you're in the sun. And
you're absolutely right, man. Yeah, it is. You go into that meditative, thoughtful state that we don't go into as much anymore because, you know, we're very quick to pull up our phone and go there. And then our mind is engaged with that versus letting it just kind of wander and meander. And that's when we, you know, that's when we come up with our best ideas and we work out problems. And so, yeah, gardening is so big for human health, emotional, mental, physical. And that's why I promote it. And that's why I'm trying to, that's why I do the YouTube channel and all the content creation to get more people inspired and try, you know, teaching them how to do it too.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's awesome. You seem to make it very accessible, at least this idea of growing a lot of food in less space. So I'm curious, you know, how did you get started in terms of in the actual work? You know, did you just go out there and start a plot, or, you know, what are some of your best practices that you've kind of figured out and how to get started?
Okay, sure. Yeah, well, I've started gardens in a lot of different ways now. Let's see. Well, one of the big things you're going to deal with in the beginning, if you just have an open lot or a field in your backyard or whatever it may be, you're going to have a lot of weed and grass issues. And a very simple way to get rid of that is to actually just use like a tarp, like a big, either a billboard tarp, you can get those for cheap, and, they're called silage tarps. And you would just, they last for a decade, and you can just put them out onto the ground. The heat will kill the grass, and then you're left with just bare soil, basically. I'm somebody who's very big into no-till. So what that means basically is you're not coming in with a rototiller, a machine that's going to tear up the soil like 12 inches deep. There's one caveat to that. I think that rototilling the first time when you're setting up your beds can be beneficial. Just because it's way easier to set up your beds. If you do it all by hand, it's a lot more work, especially if you're not going to bring in a large amount of compost. So, you know, once you've got your ground cleared, things are ready and prepped, then I would bring in a bunch of compost from a good source, hopefully one that is focused on like living soil and making sure that all that biology, the correct soil biology, is in that compost, and that's going to help inoculate your garden and your field with the nematodes and the good guy bacteria in your soil. And you can basically grow in just straight compost too. For most veg, you know, once we talk about things that have fruits like tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers, and you know, then you're going to want to make sure they have all the phosphate they need and micronutrients, minerals, and things like that. But that can be given through rock dusts and kelp, seaweed fertilizers, or fish emulsion. That's another great fertilizer as well.
So it's really for you, it's all about starting with the soil. The soil is probably the most important part, right, to grow anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm curious about, yeah, you mentioned a bunch of ways you get nutrients into the soil, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, a conventional farmer will obviously use a ton of artificial fertilizer for that, but you're using all these natural methods, right?
Yeah, I am. For the last 3 years, I don't know, about 90% of the inputs that I use I've made here. So the only things I'm really importing are rock dust, which is azomite. There's like 60-70 trace minerals in that. I like to use kelp for minerals. What else do I use? I do a little bit of fish emulsion. And then what I'm really doing is I'm making compost and worm tea, and I'm adding in all these minerals and nutrients in there to help feed the biology and to grow it out, so that when I spray that out on my soil and all the on the leaves of my plants, the plants are now getting all those minerals, all those nutrients, plus all the biology on there. You can kind of think of, when I keep saying this biology word, you could kind of think of it as a probiotic for humans, right? We're eating yogurt or kimchi, and that's going into our gut system, inoculating our gut with beneficial biology that's helping us to process and break down all the nutrients in our body so that the nutrition can be absorbed. Well, I like to think of the soil, it's not an exact analogy, but I like to think of it as kind of the stomach for plants. So if you just have raw dirt without biology, the plant doesn't have a way of accessing those nutrients. They're locked up in the sand, silt, and clay. But what the biology does, it comes in there, and with its the different acids and all the different features that these small creatures have, they're breaking down the minerals, they're breaking down the nitrogens, the carbon, all these things, and then they make it in a plant-available form for these plants. So that's why having really good plant biology in your garden or on your farm is so important, because it's this relationship between plants and soil that makes everything work. And that's what we're not seeing being done on a large scale. Large scale, they're basically giving their plants an IV drip. So yeah, they kill the soil biology.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, honestly.
Yeah, so yeah, if you know about chemical farming, they're tilling, which kills soil biology and rips apart fungal life and all that. Then they come in and they dump salts, which is NPK, nitrogen, phosphate, potassium. Maybe they're adding in some other things too, but those are salts. Salts suck away water. Soil biology needs water to survive and propagate. So it just decimates the soil biology. Yeah, they're getting the chemical nutrients. So yeah, they grow and yeah, they're green, but they're completely devoid of the nutrition that the plants need. And then therefore we don't get, they're devoid of the protective abilities that they would have if they had all the nutrients. They would be able to create chemicals that repel pests, which means that you wouldn't have to use as much pesticide. And it's just the snowball effect, basically, that happens once you remove the most important part of the natural system, which is the biology. If you took away the biology from our gut, we would die. We would not exist. And it's the same thing with plant life.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that's a really great explanation. I never thought about it like that in those terms, but it makes a lot of sense that way. So so you mentioned composting a lot. Obviously, that's a big deal for you. For someone, you know, who's having their own garden and they are currently probably a lot of people buy their compost, but if someone wants to start their own composting system, what are some do's and don'ts that you've kind of figured out over the last couple of years?
Yeah, making compost is a complex process, and it takes some time and experience to really get it down. So the first piece of advice would just be, like, don't get discouraged. You're going to have many failed piles before you get a really consistent, when you're bringing the pile up to temperature and building soil quickly. So I guess the main thing would just be to know a good ratio. So you'd want 60% carbon material, or browns, some people call it. So dried leaves, straw mulch, dried grass, things like that. And then you're going to want 40% of a nitrogen source. So things that are green. It could be grass clippings, could be old vegetable matter, kitchen scraps. And then if you can have 10% of that 40% be from an animal, like animal manure, then that's even better. Or a high nitrogen source, so maybe a plant like a legume, like beans or clover, or maybe even radishes. Those are high in nitrogen too. Anyways, so a pile of 60% carbon, 40% nitrogen, and then you're going to layer that together. So I'll do a layer of carbon at the bottom of my pile. It depends on the pile size, but you're really trying to reach a pile size of 3 feet cube or 1 yard, 1 meter cubed. And that allows you to get enough heat, because you're trying to heat up the center of that pile to anywhere from 130 degrees Fahrenheit to 160 degrees Fahrenheit. And in that temperature range, the thermophilic range, that's where you're going to kill all possible pathogens. You're going to kill weed seeds and create compost in a fast manner.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Because like, I've always wanted to start my own compost pile, but currently in the living situation I'm in, there's no way I can do that. But, you know, my goal is to one day have like a little homestead. So I appreciate cool. you sharing kind of how you do it, because I really think that the compost is one of the biggest ways to really bring nutrients to the soil, right?
Oh, big time. And it's this idea of inoculant too. It's the soil biology inoculant. I guess I just add, there's two other ways that you could compost too. Like if you don't want to do any work or any maintenance or not much. One would be worms, doing worm composting. You just have a little bin and you feed your kitchen scraps to them, and then they turn it into amazing fertilizer, pretty much the best fertilizer you could ever get. And that's very low maintenance, no work, and doesn't take skill at all or experience.
So you just buy a bunch of worms for that? Or
Okay. I have some pretty in-depth videos on my YouTube channel about making compost and about doing worm composting and how you can build your own system and everything. So check that out. But you can do a plastic tote. Some people, if they do a big system, they do bathtubs. And you're filling that up with carbon material and soil or coco coir, peat moss. People use different things for the bedding. And then you just add a little bit of vegetable matter on top. They just live in there and do their thing. And 2 to 3 months later, it's all worm castings, or it's their poop basically. And it is full of rich nitrogen, phosphate, potassium, minerals, really good soil biology, humic and fulvic acids, which are kind of the end stage of organic matter, the most like potent beneficial form for plants. So I definitely would recommend worm composting. You could even do it in your apartment.
Just in a big tub, like plastic tub or bucket or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. You can use 5 gallon buckets. That's another way to do this same exact thing. if you do a three tote system, I would definitely look that up because it makes it no work. You don't have to sort your worms from the castings. They sort themselves by going up to the next tote. And you're just like stacking three totes on top of each other. And it's like stories in an apartment. And they just go to the next one when they've eaten through the bottom story. They move to the second story and eat through that one.
Yeah, it's cool how people have, you know, kind of figured all this out, all these different systems for doing these things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really fun.
So obviously, you know, worms and then normal composting, but you also have chickens, right? I saw on your YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have them on both properties or only in one of them?
I just have them on one property, and they're awesome. So that is where my manure source is coming from my compost that I make. And I've got 20 chickens right now. And I love having animals. If you can have animals be a part of your farm, it's adding in that diversity component. It just gives you so many benefits. So I'm a big fan. Plus I get eggs. So that's fun too.
Oh man, I love eggs. And you know, there really is a difference in egg quality. I don't know. Are yours mostly like in a fence, or do you let them roam ever? How do you go about this?
I used to let them free range, but now that all my gardens are built out, they'll destroy everything. So yeah.
Well, I do have heard though that a lot of people will use them to like get rid of bugs. Is that a thing? You know, they'll let the chickens loose under a crop and they'll pick off all the bugs.
They will help. If you've got the like flea beetles or Japanese beetles or like where there's just thousands of them everywhere, I think they would do it. But the problem is they like eating greens and they like scratching the ground a lot. So they're going to do damage to your crops. They will eat some bugs too, but they're also going to damage things.
It's probably a little easier if you have like a big farm, you know, where you just have a lot of a pasture for them to kind of roam on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like that's the best. Or have them come in and take out a garden bed, have them finish off whatever's there.
Oh yeah. That's a great idea too.
And then remake the bed after they're done.
Use them as little helpers.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I try to use them as. They're like my, they're part of my compost system really, because I throw all, not all, but a lot of my old, like dead plants. I'll throw it in there with them. They eat it. They mix it into the straw. It starts decomposing before I even get it into my bigger compost pile.
Yeah, no, that's exciting. And so you use your chickens, your compost, you said your nutrient tea, which is pretty much like a literal tea, right? Out of, is that worm casting or how does that work?
Yeah, so my tea, I do compost plus worm castings together, and you put it in essentially a tea bag, I use a paint strainer, or you could use a burlap sack, and you're soaking it in water for 24 to 72 hours. Really, the 36 to 48 hour mark is usually the best for soil biology, and we're aerating it. So we're adding a ton of oxygen to prevent any anaerobic bacteria from developing more. And that's just to prevent any anaerobic bacteria. So anaerobic means without oxygen. Okay. And some anaerobic bacteria is very good. Like the bacteria in our gut is anaerobic, mostly anaerobic. The bacteria to ferment alcohol is an anaerobic bacteria. But, you know, things like E. coli and Salmonella, Listeria, these are all anaerobic thriving bacteria. So one of the reasons we aerate is to make sure those are destroyed, but also we want these aerobic bacteria that are consist of the majority of the bacteria in the soil where we're growing food. So it comes back to that kind of probiotic idea of we're growing out really healthy biology.
Yeah. And I mean, you're using all these natural methods. You're not using any of these artificial fertilizers, but you're still getting healthy plants and a lot of turnover, right?
And oh yeah,
I saw you on YouTube. You have a I think it's called a bricks meter, is that right?
Oh, uh-huh. And yeah,
can you just touch on that, because I thought that was, I'd never heard of that, but it's an amazing thing, amazing like little tool to have.
Yeah bricks is awesome, and that's spelled b-r-i-x. And you know, viticulturists and people who do grapes or beer, they've been using this tool for a very long time, and it's also called a refractometer. So like what the grape grower would do is they would take a grape, squeeze one droplet from the grape onto the refractometer. It's basically this little kind of kaleidoscope looking thing. It has a slide. You put that liquid on there, you close the flap over, and you look through the kaleidoscope or the refractometer. And it gives you a reading. And what the tool's doing is looking at dissolved solids, specifically sucrose. So there's a light frequency range that they figured out over time. And so basically what the wine grape people do is they're measuring the sugar over a period of time so that they know when to harvest the grapes so that they can guarantee a specific alcohol percentage and like flavor profile. So this bricks number, it's like 20 is like a really good number for grapes. So they've compared these bricks numbers with like nutrient analysis of these plants. So there's a correlation between higher bricks numbers or higher sucrose and nutrition in food. So it's like a $20 device you can buy on Amazon for a bricks meter. And it's a way of monitoring your crops over time. So if you could watch for 3 years your grapes, and at their peak sweetness, what's their bricks number? And then in that way, you could watch your soil and the health of your plants develop with a very simple test.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So you're pretty much using it to measure the nutrients in your plants, pretty much, to see if they're healthy and if they're nutrient-rich, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, it's specifically measuring sucrose, but we know we know that plants with high Brix also have higher nutrition, higher health, higher yields, all of those things. So we can't directly say that it has higher nutrition. We'd have to send it to a lab. But because of all the tests over the last decades, we know that it does indicate higher nutrition.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
I'd say it like that.
I mean, for $20, you know, that's something everybody could get. It's not mm-hmm. really a big deal.
Yeah.
So this whole idea of, you know, urban farming, the way you're doing it, it's all about growing more food in less space, right?
That's really the name of the game, the
big idea behind it. And I've seen you talk about interplanting strategies. Is that what it's called?
Interplanting.
Yeah, could you touch on that? And because I feel like a lot of people, you know, they think, especially when they're getting into gardening, there's kind of this consensus that your vegetables need a ton of space, individual space, but this interplanting strategy is kind of the opposite of that, right?
Yeah, and over the years, I've been amazed at like how much more I can fit into a bed than like what a lot of the books say. And really, until I read Curtis Stone's book, The Urban Farmer, he really laid out like how close you could get the plants in this market garden style of farming. So that really helped me like push what I thought was possible. So interplanting is planting different types of crops together in the same garden bed. So here's how I like to think about it. I like combining long growing crops and short growing crops together. And a lot of these longer growing crops, so let's just say broccoli, carrots, beets, peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, they're growing for a longer period of time. So, and they're growing taller. So what we can do is, knowing that, we can fit other crops planted at the same time or slightly staggered to grow underneath them so that they're able to grow to full size, but they'll also get some even extra benefit because they're getting shaded out. So in the summertime, it really helps for growing lettuce, like growing lettuce under your tomatoes or cucumbers, or lettuce under your peppers or under your squash before the squash get too big and take over the whole bed. It's a way that, so like I did that with this year with squash. I interplanted at the same time I planted my baby squash transplants. I also planted lettuce. I had that lettuce harvested in 30 days. After that 30 days, the squash had basically taken over the bed. There wasn't any more light for those lettuce. But I was able to get two crops in that same amount of time.
That's
kind of the concept.
I've like seen videos of other people too. And I think that's kind of the whole idea behind this whole market gardening movement too, right? Isn't it? I'm pretty sure I saw a book once where that's the main focus, really just all this interplanting strategy so that you can have a high yield and a high turnover on the smaller mm-hmm. space.
Exactly. It is the name of the game because, you know, we got to make as much money as we can on this small piece of land. So, you know, how can we maximize everything to the highest potential? And yeah, interplanting is definitely one of the ways to make it happen. And so, but I love it because it's not only good, for business, but for you as the home grower, utilizing these techniques. Maybe you only have 2 8x4 foot garden beds, but man, you can grow a lot of food in that if you plant it correctly.
Yeah, you just gotta know how to do it. So they gotta watch your YouTube stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, I wish a lot more people were aware of this idea of, you know, growing more food in less space, because I think space is such a huge barrier to entry for a lot of people. They always feel like if you want to grow food, you got to have a big farm, or you just got to have a big yard, a ton of garden space. But, you know, that's really not always the case. You can make it work. You just got to inform yourself. So have you ever tried growing plants, maybe like in pots? Because I'm curious. I've always thought, you know, for people in the city, because we're obviously, what you're also trying to do is to motivate people to grow their own food, right? But what about people in the city? You know, they don't have the space. So I'm thinking like they could grow food in pots, right? Maybe in, you know, even on your fire escape or on your balcony or something. Have you looked into that at all? Is that a viable option?
Yeah, actually, this last year I experimented with grow bags, which are, it's like a also called a fabric pot. And they're even, I like them a little better than your standard plastic pots because they're breathable. So it helps the soil, you know, stay a lot healthier, basically, because they're, like we talked about, aerobic, so more oxygen loving. So it helps the plant's roots develop better. They don't spiralize as much inside of the pot. Anyways, I did about 150 of these grow bags. I think there were 10-gallon ones. So I grew peppers, chard, kale, cilantro, parsley, green onion. I said kale and chard. Yeah, so I did those different plants, and they did fantastic in them. I was really happy with them. Really? Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you, it all goes back to the soil, though. So if you're filling that pot with really good compost, worm castings, some perlite or vermiculite, maybe some organic fertilizer, but, you know, you're off to the races. So, yeah, I can definitely recommend doing some stuff in apartments. You just got to keep in mind the sunlight, whether it's indirect or direct, and just focus on crops that can deal with less light, because that's probably a lot of the case with a lot of people. So, you know, things that can handle less light would be your greens. So lettuce, chard, kale, collards, or your herbs, your fresh culinary herbs, cilantro, dill, parsley, green onions. All of that can grow in shade, essentially. I've grown it in just shade. So you don't need any sun for those. They don't grow as well, of course, but you can do those in apartments. Well, the other option is supplemental lighting.
Okay, just like a grow light.
Yeah, you're doing a grow light.
Well, hey, better than nothing, right? Even if you're just getting some food. And it's I think it's just important for people to really go through the process. I think that really builds appreciation for your food, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if everybody could have a garden once in their life, I think it would change the perspective of a lot of people on things.
Yeah, for sure. So I'd like to go back to your kind of, you know, operation, that size. So you're pretty much in a neighborhood, right? And mm-hmm. You're growing, like we talked about, a ton of food in this small space. What about weeding? You know, it's weeding, I feel like, is most people's less favorite task. Is that super important? Is that something you think, you know, everyone has to do? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, weeding is a good one. Weeds are, they're an essential part of the ecosystem. So their job, their role, is to cover the earth. There's not supposed to be bare soil on the earth. The soil wants to be covered so that the ecological succession process of life can start. And it can go from weeds to more hardy plants to vegetables to bushes to vines to trees, then to really mature trees. All of nature is on this this pathway I just described. It's called ecological succession. So I try not to think of weeds as a bad thing, but more of an indicator, I guess, of what the soil really wants. But doing no-till is something that's going to really help your weed pressure, because every time you till, there's weeds deep down in the soil that have just accumulated over the years. And when you till, yeah, you're killing the weeds on the top, but then you're bringing all these seeds back up that are going to sprout on you come spring or summer. So doing no-till is highly effective. And what I've noticed after doing, 3 different no-till plots now, that after the first year or two, if you're staying on top of your weeds, you're getting rid of them, you're not letting them go to seed. I hardly do any weeding at all anymore. 10 minutes once a month or something.
That's nothing.
It's nothing, because I stayed on top of it. But another thing you could do is use landscape fabric and, you know, put the perimeter of your garden in landscape fabric so that no weeds get through that little section. Or using wood chip mulch is pretty effective as well to keep weeds down. So there's a lot of options.
Yeah, and mulching is definitely a big one, right? Would hay or grass work too?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Just make sure there's no seeds in that grass. Otherwise, you're bringing in the weeds.
Yeah. And then there's, I mean, there is some weeds that you can eat, you know. I know this year I just learned about lamb's quarters.
Yeah, that's delicious.
I mean, yeah, it's delicious, and it, I mean, it grows in the wild. I usually get it from the wild, but it tends to really grow around garden beds, right? Because it likes that disturbed soil.
Right.
So, you know, maybe do a little research, and maybe you're throwing away weeds that you could be eating.
Yeah, it's so true, man. Yeah, I looked up all the weeds in my yard at one point because I was like, man, this... Because I wanted to feed it all to my chickens, and I went, what is this stuff? And yeah, like 80% of it was edible, actually. And I was wow, no way. Yeah, it's like mallow is a very common weed that we have out here. And it's really good for your digestion, and it's pretty good.
Well, I really love how you're, you know, the farming system you're using, it really looks at every part of nature. It really looks at it as this whole system. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is also the pollinators, right?
Definitely.
And
oh, yeah.
You have bees, if I'm correct.
Yeah, well, I had honeybees at my parents' house.
Okay.
But unfortunately, those got robbed by some ants. So they flew off. It was horrible.
I thought you were going to say someone took them. I'm like,
oh no. Yeah, good luck trying to steal a bunch of bees.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, I had them for like a year, and I've just been too busy to do bees again. I do plan on doing that again in the future, but I also did what are they called, mason bees and leafcutter bees, and these are native bees to North America. I tried these out this year. They don't make honey. They don't sting. They're just insanely, insanely good pollinators.
So you just have them on your property and they go out and do their work?
Yep. Yeah, like, I don't know if you've ever seen, they're called insect hotels. And you've probably seen there's like these little tubes or like things like that in them.
I built one actually with my stepbrother once.
Oh, nice. Those are for mason and leafcutter bees a lot of times. That's one of the species that they're trying to help.
So they just came there naturally? Or
I got mine from crownbees.com, and they're just a company in the US that raises them and is promoting these pollinators. And they're pretty fascinating because, you know, there's the whole honeybee population collapse. Well, those bees are from Europe. They're not even from America. We don't have native honeybees in North America.
Really?
I didn't know that for a long time. Yeah,
I had no idea. Yeah.
They're native now. They live in the wild now because they're out there, but they were brought here by the Europeans.
Okay.
So the bottom line is, like, we're, you know, pollinating our almond orchards and avocado groves and all these things. It could be done by the native bees if we set up hives for them. So that's kind of an interesting idea that will happen in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. That's very true. What about, do you plant like specific flowers that might act as, you know, or that might attract pollinators?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've got a couple sections of my garden that aren't in the production area. They're just off on the side, basically, where yarrow, alyssum, sunflowers, like echinacea, a bunch of random stuff. I just like have got random seeds and planted them. My wife did a flower garden, like, you know, lupine and borage, comfrey. Some of these flower, like borage and comfrey, I take those and I ferment them and I make nutrients out of them, essentially.
Yeah, there's so many ways to use plants and use what you got to, you know, make your own fertilizer, essentially. I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So that's something I'm studying more and more, and I want to bring to my YouTube channel.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. You know, once I have the space, I'll definitely be, you know, trying to work together with you or watch your YouTube stuff more and try to apply some of those techniques, because it's just awesome that you're making it so available. And like putting your whole journey out there, that's a great idea.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, that was the idea. I wanted to show how you could start in a backyard with nothing, and then, you know, where it goes into the future. So I'm happy to share everything with everybody.
Well, we all appreciate it. So I have heard you say you are not, you don't have like an organic label on your produce. So you're not like USDA certified, right?
No, definitely not. I would never, be certified.
Yeah. Is it just because you're small scale or do you not?
Yeah.
Do you have, what's your opinion on the whole USDA certified in general?
Yeah. So I'll give like two perspectives on it. If you're at a scale where you are not no longer the brand, like the label is the brand, like what is it called? Earthbound Farms. They grow a lot of the greens in the United States. You know, you get those salad boxes from Sprouts or whatever. In their case, or like you're a big brand, I think having the USDA label helps you because then it gives you some sort of face or, you know, some sort of proof that you're doing things in maybe a correct way. But if we want to get into what the USDA label actually is, it's not that impressive. Yes, it's better. Yes, if I buy food from the grocery store, I buy USDA organic, but they are allowed to use different types of pesticides, herbicides. They till the ground, which is destroying soil biology. They do monoculture, growing one crop and acres of land. So they're doing lots of things that are detrimental to soil health and to, they're not growing the healthiest food possible. But having said that, the herbicides and pesticides, these things that they're using are far safer, for human biology. So like that aspect is good about it. You know, like I used to push for, man, we need to change everything right now. And but in reality, like, things are going to change slowly over time and get better and better as we introduce more of these natural growing techniques to these larger scale growers. You know, their bottom line is everything. And if it can't be shown that they can make money farming in a more natural way, then they're going to keep everything with the status quo since it works. But the USDA label has been highly manipulated over time, unfortunately. As with all regulatory agencies, like, this is what happens. So knowing your farmer is the way to know if how your food is grown and all of that.
Honestly, like, that's what I say on the podcast always, to really try to, you know, find your farmers, go out in farmers markets and or really go to the farm, because a lot of times I'm sure you'd be fine with people coming to your farm and checking everything out, you know, and having them convince themselves that what you're doing is, you know, 100% natural and it's the real deal.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's another benefit of market gardening, is the farmer a lot of times is the brand, or, you know, the farm itself is the major thing that everyone wants to see and know about. And it's very personal. Whereas some big 1,000-acre farm, you don't know who the farmer is, what methods they're doing, nothing. So it's a huge advantage that we have as small farmers over them.
Yeah, no, for sure. And yeah, like you said, the whole personal aspect, you can ask questions and you can really learn about your food in that way and maybe even, you know, be motivated to start your own thing, which is what we want.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
I'm curious about like the workload of the operation you're running right now. You know, maybe there's someone out there who is thinking about starting their own urban farm and really selling their produce as well. So what's a week in the life of Steven look like, or how much time are you putting into all of this?
Yeah, sure. I'll try to put it into some context. So I'm growing on basically 5,000 square feet. Plus I have my chickens. I have a 200 square foot greenhouse where I do all my starts. How many beds do I have? I have like 26 garden beds that are about 40 feet long, 2.5 feet wide. You know, I'd say like 30 hours a week plus my market days or day. So like 50 hours a week, something like that, to manage everything, all the work, I'd say. Sometimes of the year, though, it's like less work. As we're going into winter, there's less bed turnover and things like that. So the workload will slow down a bit, but we're talking 50 to 70 hours a week, depending on what's going on. And I could definitely farm more land than this, but I, you know, doing YouTube and those things takes up a lot of my time as well. But if, yeah, if someone wanted to get into it and start, you know, I'd say probably 5,000 square feet minimum so that you could make enough money to live and pay your bills. But ideally a quarter acre is, I think, a bit more stable business just to make sure that you're bringing in enough cash flow and all of that stuff.
So you would say it is a viable way of making a living because, you know, yeah, I think well, obviously you're making it work, but, and with the help you're putting out there, I think a lot of other people could do it. And because I think a lot of people, you know, probably my age, I'm in my early 20s and, you know, people my age and even older, they shy away from this kind of work because they, you know, they think they're never going to make a living doing it, even though they might want to do it, but, you know, they're just very discouraged.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a different lifestyle. You know, my wife and I, I got a 99 Tacoma and a 99 Civic. You know, we don't have debt. We don't go and spend a bunch of money out on a night out. We, you know, we're eating a lot of the food that we grow. So our expenses are very low, and that's what makes it possible. You know, in my farm in this third year, it pays for all of our expenses to live. It pays for the business itself. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely doable and I could be making a lot more money if I did more microgreens or there's other little business avenues I could do with just growing food to make this business work even better. So it is a lot of work, definitely. But you can definitely make a decent living doing this type of work. But you're not going to own a Mercedes. You're not going to get to do the $5,000 vacation or, you know, you got to have a bigger farm to be able to do that.
Yeah. But I think, you know, a lot of people, they might not even want that. They just really want to make a living and, it is possible as you know, you're a perfect example of it. So, how do you go from growing to selling? I think that's a big thing that some might intimidate some people. You sell most of your food on or your produce on farmers markets, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, selling is what, you know, it's one of the hardest parts about farming. But, you know, just as hard as growing, I'd say. And so, yeah, farmers markets, direct to how do I get started? Well, in the beginning, I think you're going to start really small, like 500 square feet, little garden. Start selling to your friends, your neighbors, you know, go through social media to find customers. And once you have enough scale, then you could start doing a CSA system, like a subscription system where people would buy veggies every week in a box from you. If you have a market in your area that can support, you know, hundreds of dollars, hopefully $1,000 a week worth of produce, I think markets are a great venue because you're going to get a lot of practice communicating with customers, learning what they like and don't like. It'll help you in the future, even if you don't do a market. It's a good way to meet chefs even because usually they're in major areas and chefs will buy from farmers markets. You know, you really just got to put yourself out there, call people, call restaurants, go in there, give the chef a sample order. And if your food is really good, which if you're growing on a small scale beyond organically, you're going to have incredible quality that they can't get anywhere else. And that is kind of one of the biggest selling points is the food tastes way better. It'll stay fresher a lot longer. And I'm local. I can bring it to you in 15 minutes, chef. You know, I'm right down the road.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, so that's perfect. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Because, if I were to start this, you know, I'd have no idea how to really bring it to the market. So it's always good to hear from someone who's, you know, kind of an expert on it at this point, right?
And then, it is hard, though. It's like, especially for us farmers, like, we don't want to be out there doing sales. Like that's a nightmare for most of us. So. Yeah.
But I feel like you do build a lot of great relationships at these farmers markets. Like I've gone to the one up here and I live in Wisconsin in Madison just as a customer, I mean, I met so many cool farmers. I got their cards. I built, you know, some relationships. They told me to come visit their farm and all that. It's just, I really, you know, enjoy doing that. And I think it's a great way of building a community around it.
Yeah, totally agree. It's so fun. That's what I love about farmers markets too. And yeah, I fell in love with farmers markets like, yes, 8 or 9 years ago. And yeah, I loved building that relationship. And I felt like I knew the person that was growing my food. And when you think about it, it's kind of silly, like how we know our mechanic or, you know, I don't know, our computer repairman or something like better than we know our farmer. And the farmer is literally giving us things that build the cells of our body, and we don't even know who they are.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, what?
Yeah, right. It's a great way of putting it, because, yeah, we are what we eat, you know, where you got to really see your body almost as like an engine, and you're putting the fuel in there. And obviously, you want to use the highest quality food you can get, or energy you can get. So you also use this thing called the Vendor app, right? Can you talk about that a little bit? I haven't used it personally, but I've looked into it a little bit, and it's an amazing idea.
It is. Yeah. So this is done by my buddy, Sam Lilly. And you can download it on the iOS app store or the Android app store. And it's just basically a local grocery shopping app. But you're buying from either local farmers, small farmers, or gardeners even, which I love that because I know lots of gardeners who, you know, they've got too much squash and they don't know what to do with it. You know, this is a way you can sell some of that or trade. You can also even contact chefs now through that app and, you know, have it's like a big ordering system. So, you know, if you like Let Go or OfferUp or any of these selling app, Craigslist, these selling apps, it's like that, but specifically for locally grown produce.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, what better way of connecting people, right? Most people are using technology these days anyways, and this just makes it super easy.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a big part of the farming movement going forward. Because we're competing with like the Amazon Prime, the Amazon Fresh,
yeah,
Fresh to
Amazon
You.
Amazon Fresh, yeah.
There's a lot of different large scale farms putting together these CSA models. You know, people want stuff delivered to their house. We're competing on convenience now, and I think that moving forward, we really gotta keep that in mind and develop systems like Vendor and other things that are going to help make it more streamlined and painless for the end consumer.
Yeah, I'll have to see. Maybe I can get those guys in the podcast sometime too and really talk about it a little more. I think they are up here in Wisconsin too now. I think I looked at their map.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, good.
But I'm not 100% on it, but I'll make sure to check in or look into that a little bit more. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the farming aspect and gardening aspect and producing the food. But the podcast is really, you know, making that connection between farm to table, forest to table. So I'd love to, you know, really just look at the whole process. So I'd love to maybe ask you a couple questions on how, you know, what you're doing with your harvest at home and how you're using it in the kitchen and all that. So do you do a lot of cooking?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love cooking.
That's awesome, because that's another thing that people are really missing out on these days, I think, with all the convenience food.
Oh yeah, I totally agree.
So what are some of your favorite ways to use your harvest in the kitchen?
Well, a lot of times I will make things, you know, whatever I have like leftover from the market or whatever I have an abundance of, I'll take that and then make a dish out of it basically. And I don't know, I'm somebody who doesn't like to do recipes too often. So I'll just kind of just make it up and add a bunch of herbs and salt and pepper and all that and make it taste how I want. But I love making, like coming up here to winter, I love making a veggie or like a mostly veggie with some meat soup. It's so good.
Like a minestrone, so, like in, yeah, vegetable
soup. Yeah, I guess
soup.
So. Yeah, I just make it up. I just like throw a bunch of stuff in there. But yeah,
that's how I cook, you know, just simple food. Once you really engage with all these ingredients, it's just so much fun to just make up your own stuff and, you know, just see what tastes good. And that way you'll learn too about all the different foods. And I just love doing it as well. So do you have
very creative?
Yeah, oh yeah, very creative. Do you have like a favorite food to cook?
Well, I it's not something I cook actually. It'd be my salad mix and my microgreens that I grow. I have a salad almost every day, and I live on that stuff. That's I don't know, something about salad and microgreens. Like nothing makes me feel better than when I eat that every day.
Yeah, I mean that's loaded, right, with nutrients right there.
Oh yeah. But besides that, yeah, I'd say making soups, and I like doing roasts a lot in the oven with a bunch of different veggies and then like a meat dish as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm big on roasts too. So I hunt a lot. Well, I do get like a deer a year, I'd say, but my goal really is to get wild meat completely or not have to buy any meat from the farmer at one point in life, so that I'll just have a whole year's supply of meat that I pretty much got from the wild.
Oh, that's so cool, man. That's my dream too, actually, someday.
Have you ever gone hunting?
No, I really want to. I really, really want to. I just don't have, I don't have any like friends really that do it. I'm in California, so.
Yeah, and definitely makes it a little harder.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Well, hey man, if you're ever up here and shoot me a message, you know, I'll give you some of my meat if I have some around.
Thank you. Thank you.
It really is the best meat I think you can get. You know, I don't want to support the whole factory farming thing.
Exactly.
Obviously I'm not perfect. Every now and then, you know, I'll still do it, but if I can one day, the goal is really to have just wild meat.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think a lot of people, it'd be great if a lot of people started thinking like that.
Yeah, I think so too. So one more thing. One thing I've always wondered about, and I feel like you might, you know, not have a good answer to this, is what's the best way to store vegetables in the fridge? Is there a good like best practice you've kind of figured out? Because you probably have a lot, right?
Yeah, no, I do know a lot about that. I guess the first thing I'd recommend is to get some like plastic containers. What's the name of the one I have? They sell them at all the stores now, but it's just like a piece of plastic and two rubber lids on the top and bottom, and it allows for like a tiny bit of airflow. But basically, all of your salad greens, like delicate things, so like arugula and spinach and cut up salad mix, that does best actually just in a plastic bag, or put it in one of these permanent plastic containers. And you could put like a paper towel in there that'll help absorb excess moisture, because the reason why your greens are kind of melting is because of the water. The water's there. There's some biology that are on the leaves, and so they start breaking down the plant, and that's why it gets all gooey. So keeping it very pretty darn dry is a good thing. So for greens like that, things like chard and kale and collard greens, those also do good in a plastic bag, or if you can have a permanent container, it'll last at least a week. If you just put it like these large leaves in your fridge, they wilt real quickly. And the whole thing about putting them in plastic is that they can't perspire and release all their water. If they do, it's released in the bag and it just kind of circulates in there. So that'd be the big ways I'd say is, there's certain things you want to have moisture and there's certain things that you don't want to have moisture.
Yeah, I feel like something like maybe like a potato or like a sweet potato, more to the starchier rooted vegetables, those can probably just kind of sit in there, right?
Yeah, and I actually just keep all those. Usually I just keep them on my counter. Potatoes and sweet potato, onion, garlic, all that just sits on my table there, because they should be cured after they're grown. They let them sit around and then they develop their own natural preservation.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know about that. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some, you know, eventually you have to refrigerate stuff, but you know, potatoes and garlic, you definitely don't have to.
All right. Well, I think you probably think about this quite a lot, or you know, it's probably part of your mission. So how do we get more people to start thinking deeply about their food and really where it comes from?
That is a great question. And I wish I had a true answer to that, other than I think just exposing people to if you're into growing your own food and eating really healthy, I think a great way to influence would just be to invite your friends over for dinner and have them experience that. I think experience is probably the most impactful way we could reach people. Beyond them having kind of that wake up, oh my goodness moment, which we'd rather them not have, like they have a health problem. But yeah, I think experience, giving people, like having people come over to your garden and say, hey, just spend an hour with me out here and, you know, see what it's like. And I think that can change people's minds.
Yeah, totally. That's really, for me, like I said at the beginning of the show, doing my own garden, hunting, you know, and even helping out on farms like dairy farms and all that, just really all the exposure, all the experience within those systems kind of woke me up. And I think that's the only true way to really get people to really respect your food and think about it deeply in that way.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
So are there any books you can recommend to people, you know, who might want to get started with urban farming, anything that influenced you? Mm.
Definitely. I'd say my two favorite books to get started, as this may be thinking about it like a business, would be definitely Curtis Stone, The Urban Farmer. That's just a real breakdown of how to grow these specific crops for market and lots of different techniques and washing and preparing. The gardening / kind of ecology book that I would recommend would be Gaia's Garden. I'm forgetting the author's name. But Gaia's Garden, and that'll give you a big introduction into this, the interplanting, a lot of permaculture techniques, like integrating, talking about soil biology, talking about the design and layout of your garden, working with all the different species that are going to, like, you know, birds and bugs and all of that. So those two are probably my favorite for intro books.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll try to find those and link those in the show notes for the people to find easily, or maybe if you find the author name of, I'm sure there's only like one Gaia's Garden book out there.
So there is.
Yeah. It's probably not very hard to find.
Yeah.
So is there,
I have one more book.
Yeah.
It's about to come out. It's a Richard Perkins book. He's a regenerative farmer in Sweden. But this book is going to be like the ultimate book. And he goes over raising chickens, birds, cows, pigs, microgreens, market gardening, flowers, like everything. He's one of the world's best farmers, in my opinion.
Wow, I'll
check out Richard
Perkins.
That.
Yeah, I'll have to get that. And maybe even my stepbrother in Germany, you know, like I said, he's working on a biodynamic farm over there right now. So maybe I'll even get that for him for Christmas. I hope he's not listening.
That'd be an awesome gift.
Yeah. So is there anything, you know, we talked about a lot, but is there anything you feel like we didn't cover? And we'll get to, you know, where people can find you in a second here, but anything you want to add?
I don't know. I guess I would just add, if you're at all interested in this, to just go for it. And don't be hesitant. Go for it. Know that there will be failures, but the payoff and the benefit that you're going to get from gardening is going to be so worth it. And it's just added so much value to my life. Just, you know, personally, I want other people to discover that as well. So if you're at all on the fence about it, just go for it, try it, buy some transplants from your nursery, throw it in a pot and give it some water and go from there.
Yeah, that's a great way or a great final word, I'd say. I like that a lot. Just go out and try it. Just do it, you know.
Yeah.
So where can people find you?
Sure. So my website, naturesalwaysright.com. You can kind of find everything through there. But I'm super active on Instagram and, of course, YouTube and Facebook as well. If you just search Nature's Always Right, I'll come up on those platforms.
And you also have a Patreon, right?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, to support my work, making videos, and I do a lot of farm tours where I go visit other farmers or gardeners and talk to them about their journey and their story and showing their work as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks, man, for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I mean, you're just a wealth of knowledge. You've learned so much, and you are really good at, you know, passing it along. So we need those kind of teachers out there, I think. And yeah, all the YouTube content you're doing, it's just super high quality. And yeah, I'm excited to follow you on your journey. And, you know, one day I'll hopefully be able to apply a lot of this stuff to my own garden or my own little homestead.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I can't wait to see you do that as well.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll link everything in the show notes for people so they can find you. And, yeah, just thanks for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure. It was a blast. Thanks for having me on.
All right, awesome. That's all I have for you guys today. Please, please, please share this episode with your family and friends. Share it in social media. Also, make sure you hit that subscribe button in your podcast app. The podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. You can either find an awesome subscribe page on my website, which is www.theyearofplenty.com. Or if you go to my Instagram or Twitter, my Instagram is @PoldyWieland, and the Twitter handle is TheYearOfPlenty. In the bio, you'll find a link that takes you to all the subscribe links for all the platforms. So it's super easy. You can also, you know, just grab your friend's phone, your mom's phone, or your grandpa's phone, and just, you know, hit the subscribe button for them. Finally, if you like this episode and you could learn something from it, please leave a 5-star review in your podcast app. This is just going to let new listeners find a podcast and also allow the podcast to get ranked. And this way, more foodies like you and me can join us in exploring all these foods and food processes. Also, I just want to say thank you to anyone who takes time out of their day to listen to these episodes. And I've been getting great feedback from you guys. So please keep that up. That's really going to allow me to, you know, make the show better and make sure that I'm giving you guys some value. Thank you for listening. See you soon.